meeting an octopus is, it's one of those things you really hope might happen every time you go in the ocean. And then when it finally does happen, you have to pinch yourself. I was snorkeling off the coast of Mauritius, little island in the Indian Ocean. I'll stop in one place and have a bit of a better look around and see if there's anything there that I might not have first seen. And that was the moment when I noticed that something was watching me. A pair of eyes was down there on the reef, a metre or so below me. And at first, yeah, I saw its eye. This big, open eye was looking at me, peering through the corals. It was really blended in with the corals and multiple colours, and you could see that its skin was textured, raised in bumps. It was doing its best to look like a coral, weedy-covered rock. But once you've seen an octopus, you know, things are different, I think. I can tell you all the stories I want about what it's like to see an animal that's really watching you back and that has this strange something going on behind its eyes. But once you see that, you'll understand what I mean.
This is Oceans, Life Underwater, a podcast series all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them. I'm Hannah Stitful. I'm a zoologist, wildlife filmmaker and broadcaster, and I'm on a mission to learn everything I can about our five oceans. Today's episode, octopuses.
We have to remember what they are. I mean, these are invertebrates. Their closest relatives, slugs and clams. And yet amongst all of these fairly simple animals with a fairly limited number of nerves in their bodies, there's the octopuses.
Did you know there are around 300 different kinds of octopus and that they date back to before the dinosaurs?
For me, the octopuses are this weird little thing that just happened. We're still trying to figure out why and how.
This is Oceans, Life Underwater, Episode 7. So today, guys, I'm really excited to have Helen Scales back as my guest for today's episode. Now, Helen's a marine biologist, author and broadcaster, and she loves diving with these incredible, bizarre creatures. Welcome back, Helen.
Hello. It's lovely to be back. Thanks for having me.
So we're here today to talk all about octopuses. So we're going to delve into the shape-shifting, three hearts, blue blood, all of that. And you are a top fan. I mean, I can see. Let's have a look at your t-shirt. I mean, we've got to talk about it.
Isn't it awesome? Yeah, I'm a bit of a fan of octopuses, as you can see. This is an Argonaut, and perhaps we'll come back to them. They are really, in my view, one of the best octopuses. But there are so many to choose from, it's hard. But yeah, they're pretty cool. There's a lot of love for the tentacles, their arms, and the suckers, and the, you know, we all like a bit of a giant squid Cthulhu moment as well, don't we? There's something about cephalopods that people find irresistible.
I just love that you've come on brand. It's great.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So how many different types of octopus do we have? I was reading we've got about, is it between 700 and 800 cephalopods? But how many octopus?
Yeah, I think there's about 300 species that we found so far, but more all the time. A couple of weeks ago, there was an announcement that some deep sea researchers off the coast of Costa Rica have found maybe 4 new species.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we are finding more. But yeah, kind of around about 300.
And tell us about their skin, which is like no other.
It is amazing. And you really do. If you see an octopus, whether it's in an aquarium or in the wild, you instantly get that sense that it has got this incredible colour changing and also texture. So, they have chromatophores in their skin, which are these amazing structures that basically are little blobs of pigment that can either squeeze closed so you don't see them, or they can open right up and you can see them. So it's like a kind of pixel, basically, sort of changing size. And they're of all different colours and they're all controlled by nerves. So they're basically, the colours on the skin of an octopus are like this direct connection to their nervous systems, to their brains. And they're controlling, intricately controlling second by second the colour that their skin is. And then, yeah, little muscles also can make them look bumpy, like moss or seaweed. I mean, the first time I saw an octopus, all I saw was an arm kind of whisk past me. It was in the middle of all the seaweed, so it was much more kind of gardeny seaweed, but of that sight. And I just saw these suckers go past, and I was like, octopus! And if I hadn't seen that, I would not. And the only reason I then noticed where it was sitting was because I'd seen it, the suckers kind of sweep past, because it was so well camouflaged. You know, you read about it, and I know that octopuses use their colours for camouflage, but when you see it, it's like, yeah.
It's in a split second.
Yeah, they can, and, you know, they absolutely, I mean, I've seen incredible footage of octopuses. It's a very similar thing, like an octopus basically pretending to be a bit of seaweed, sitting on a bit of coral, reedy coral, and being like, nope, I'm not here. And then the diver with the camera coming a bit closer, and then it suddenly just erupts and turns white, instantly white. But yeah, this, the white thing is a kind of startle response. They're basically trying to get you to be shocked. And it was quite shocking when I saw it. So you can imagine if it was a predator, they might be like, oh, okay, I'll leave you alone. And it gives them a second to then swim off and escape. So they use their colours for camouflage, for, yeah, scaring predators. And they probably, I think, are communicating with it too. And, you know, there's things going on between octopuses, and they're using, we certainly know for other cephalopods, things like, there are squid we think have kind of different patterns that mean different things that we're trying to sort of slowly understand, that they're communicating with each other through their colours and patterns on their bodies. Because they don't make any noises. So this is like that one way they can actually communicate.
So how, I mean, we know that they're intelligent, but how intelligent are they really? I mean, all of these, they're decision-making all of the time, really. I mean, these are all decisions to change their colours.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And like one of the coolest species, I think, for that is the mimic octopus, which is one I would love to see. I have not seen a mimic octopus. They live in Indonesia. And they basically do impersonations of other animals, but a whole bunch of different other animals. Not just, they don't just mimic one thing, but they can make decisions about, okay, I'm going to be a flatfish, and they wrap their arms around and make themselves all flat and swim across the seabed like a flatfish does. Or I'm going to be a sea snake, and they put six of their arms down a hole and have two of them out and make them black and white and stripy like a sea snake. And then they use the tip of their arm, they sniff around as if it was the head of a sea snake. Oh, amazing. And they make these decisions, and lots of other things. They can be lionfish, they can be a bunch of other kind of dangerous animals. And they're basically trying, I think, to persuade a predator to leave them alone. Like, they're like, no, I'm not a soft, delicious octopus. I'm a very dangerous, poisonous lionfish or whatever. but yeah, they're making those decisions second by second in terms of how they behave. So it's things like that that give us a sense. Octopuses clearly do have a lot going on in terms of their cognitive abilities. And we have to remember what they are. I mean, these are invertebrates. These are animals that their closest relatives, sure, are things like squid and cuttlefish, but within the mollusks, they're, you know, slugs and clams and mussels and snails, you know, things that we really wouldn't look at and go, okay, that's a very intelligent problem-solving, complex creature. They're very different. And yet amongst all of these fairly simple animals with a fairly limited number of nerves in their bodies, there's the octopuses. Suddenly, suddenly they appear on this incredibly distant part of the animal kingdom, if you like, the animal, you know, family tree to us vertebrates. They're doing it all by themselves. And that raises so many interesting questions. But it also makes it really difficult to understand how intelligent they are and how to test them, because they're so different to us. Their whole bodies are made in completely different ways. Their nervous systems. Humans have about 100 billion nerve cells. You know, we are very brainy thing creatures. And we're used to having all of that, the idea of having all of that, most of those nerves in our brains, right? Octopuses have got 500 million nerve cells, but half of that is in their arms. And half of that is in what's the equivalent of a brain for them, which is the sort of knot of, you know, kind of concentration of them in their heads. But half of their nervous systems are in their arms, which is completely different to the way we operate as vertebrates. So, you know, they've evolved intelligence entirely separately to us, and they do it in a very different way. So testing and understanding that is really hard. But there are clues. I think anyone who's spent any time with an octopus studying them, just has this sense that there's something different about them. And they do, they behave in really curious ways. They're very curious creatures, brilliant at solving problems, and they remember the solutions that, you know, they can do things like...
Yeah, have they? They've been found to use tools, haven't they?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. One of my favourites of that is the coconut carrying octopus. If you've seen the video, if you haven't, just check it out. It's wonderful. It's an octopus that basically finds two empty halves of a coconut that have been cut in half by a human. Like, this is a coconut that's been, you know, neatly cut down the middle to take out the meat inside. It's found them at the bottom of the sea, picked them together, worked out that they go together. These are two parts of.
Yes, I have seen this.
It's really cool. Well, it finds one half, picks it up, and uses its arms as legs, because octopuses can actually sort of walk across the seabed if they want to. So it does that, picks up this one half of a coconut, finds another half and goes, oh, look, they go together, and carries it around and uses it and hides inside. It's like a little mobile shelter. But basically what it means, it, more than it's kind of just a cool video, it's showing us that they use tools and they also have like a plan. Like they realise that I might not need this coconut now, but if I carry it with me, there's going to come a point where I need to hide because something's going to come and try and eat me. So I'll carry it along with me and I'll climb inside and close it down. So they are smart. They are really smart.
And how did they evolve? I mean, I was reading that fossilized remains date back to pre-dinosaurs.
Yeah, I think we know that the group, so the coleoids, I think is how you say it. So the group that includes cuttlefish and squid within the cephalopods dates to around somewhere between 160 and 100 million years ago. I mean, the cephalopods themselves go way back into like the Cambrian. Like, we've got really weird ancestors of octopuses when they still had shells, because most octopuses don't. Yeah, sort of 500 million years ago. But then they kind of, it was a bit more recently that they branched off to what we now have as the modern cuttlefish, octopuses and squid. So yeah, they've been around in the ocean has had cephalopods for a long time, and they've done lots of really cool things in their evolution. I think for me, the octopuses are this just like weird little thing that just happened. I mean, in all of the rest of life that's evolved, it's like, there they are, and we're still trying to figure out why and how.
And what would you say is your favourite species? Ooh. If you had to pick one?
Tough, again, really tough. I mean, because there's everything to go from, like, the blue-wing octopus with their amazing poisons. Oh, gosh, I mean, incredible things. To blanket octopuses, which float through the open ocean. They're one of the few that live not on the bottom of the sea. Most octopuses do live on the seabed, but these ones swim around. And they tear off the arms of jellyfish and use them as weapons. So, again, like, tool use in them. Like, they carry them around, like... I've got a stinger here, like I'm going to use it possibly to catch their own food. But if you push me to just choose one, it would be the Argonauts. They are really awesome, the ones that are on my beautiful T-shirt, so you have to check that out. And the person who drew the beautiful picture is a good friend of mine. They are the only octopuses that make shells, and they've come back to shell making. So, you know, the ancestors of octopuses and were other mollusks that lived inside a hard shell that covered up their whole bodies. And then basically in that kind of 160 million years ago, things were changing in the ocean and there were a lot more big predators around. Life was becoming very dangerous, and different groups of animals responded and evolved in different ways. Because, you know, there were things like ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs and great big giant marine reptiles just terrorizing the oceans. Some animals built bigger, thicker shells to protect themselves. But the ancestors of octopuses lost their shells and basically became very nimble and quick to escape from predators. But the Argonauts have kind of come back to shell making, and they do it in a completely different way. They use, you might be able to just make out my T-shirt. There's like two weird kind of ends to two of their arms, which look like webs. They're like silvery webs, which is what it's actually red in this picture. And it's the adapted ends of two arms, which they make the shell with. It's like a kind of shell making kind of, yeah, like a web. And it's the females that do this. It's only the females that do this. And we know all of this thanks to an incredible scientist from the 19th century, a lady from France called Jean Villepreux Power. And she wanted to figure out the truth about Argonauts. People had found their shells washed up on beaches, and they'd occasionally seen these little octopuses inside them. And a lot of scientists assume that they were parasitizing. They'd stolen the shells from someone else. Because, you know, octopuses don't make shells. That's what we, at that, you know, of what course. People thought. So they, you know, they were like, haha, these are, you know, shell stealing creatures. And, you know, that's the story. But she basically started doing studies on them. You know, she knew, she worked out that, yes, these animals can come all the way out of their shells. So not, if you try to get, take a snail out of its shell, it's bad news for the snail. Like, that's it. They're
game over.
Yeah, game over. They're stuck inside their shells. But an argonaut can come all the way out. They just make them and hold on to them with their suckers on their arms, their eight arms. She would leave little bits of broken shell on the bottom of these aquarium tanks, and they would sort through them and find the bit that matched the hole in the shell and, like, glue it back on. So they could fix these shells. They clearly weren't just stealing them from someone else. Argonauts are one of those species we get quite a bit in the deep sea where there's a big difference between the males and the females, like anglerfish.
Yeah.
So male argonauts are teeny, teeny, tiny compared to the females, and they have one specialised arm, as most octopuses do, which delivers the sperm. And scientists used to think that this was a worm. They thought it was a parasitic worm, but in fact it was the male arm that gets dropped and the females collect them. And she puts them inside her shell, and then the male has done his bit and he goes and dies, as many octopuses do. They don't live very long. And she can carry around several of these sperm-laden arms in her shell and use them when she wants to fertilise her eggs. Then the shell is like a mobile brood chamber to carry around with her and rear her eggs in, and that's what that's for. So she deliberately makes it and definitely doesn't steal it from someone else. And they're beautiful things. They're little octopuses. They're silvery and small, really delicate. And just to imagine that it was made by this little octopus, it's just really cool.
Well, you've sold them to me. That's it. Argonauts all the way.
They are really lovely. It's a few different species. And they live in the open high seas. So, you know, it's really hard to see these things. They're really mysterious.
So that makes an encounter even more special. Wouldn't it be great to be an octopus for a day? Just to have those eight arms.
Oh, my gosh.
Just to feel what they feel.
Yes.
And to be able to change colour and morph into... great.
Completely different way of being... And he is just a sort of intelligent, sensitive creature in a completely different way to us. Oh, yeah, 100% I would take octopus. Yes, please.
So, guys, we're just taking a quick break, but if you could please, please help us and spread the word about Oceans Pod by hitting the follow button. And come join the conversation on our socials as well, at Oceans Pod. Now, we're on TikTok, Instagram, and X/Twitter. There's some really cool video content on there, so come and join us. How sociable are they? Do they form communities?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting thing, actually. And there's some really fascinating studies coming out of Australia with this at the moment. So up until not too long ago, we basically, marine biologists generally agreed that octopuses are not very sociable creatures. They are generally fairly asocial, fairly antisocial towards each other. You know, people tell me that if you try to keep them in captivity together, they generally just have fights and eat each other. They're quite cannibalistic. Yeah, so they don't get on well. Most species mate at a distance. I mean, I've told you about the argonaut dropping its arm. I mean, that's kind of taking things to an extreme. Like, here you go, dear. Here's what you need. I'm out of here.
Here's the goods.
Bye. Most of them don't necessarily fall off, but the male will reach from a distance because also, you know, he just doesn't want to get too close to her. He will, like, reach an arm out and be like, here you go. Thanks. As a couple that do properly mate face-to-face, but that's a bit more unusual. So octopuses generally not particularly friendly towards each other. And then a few years ago, some divers in Australia in Jervis Bay noticed an area, quite a small area of seabed, covered in scallop shells, where there was about 15 octopuses all living in a fairly small area together. And then they found a second site with a similar kind of thing going on. And they called one of them Octopolis and the other one Octlantis, which I wasn't like. And I think, as far as I know, they're really rare to find a site like that with octopuses kind of living together. The theory is, they don't really know for sure, we think what's going on in that particular site is that it's all about the scallops, basically. So octopuses being soft-bodied and quite vulnerable to predation, basically have to hide as much as they can, the ones that live on the seabed anyway. And they build dens and they live in the seabed and they kind of dig holes in the or find caves to hide in and stay away from predators. So they would basically go to the scallop beds, pick up the nice, biggest, juiciest scallops, take them back to their dens, then just dump them. They're pretty untidy creatures. They just leave their waste outside their front doors. So basically over time, as more shells were brought in to be eaten, there was more material to use as a building material, and more octopuses came. So it was this kind of combination of food and shelter that seems to have brought them to basically tolerate each other in this kind of close-knit community, you know, this close-knit group. You know, they have fights still with each other. And then, and again, I think, yeah, there's amazing, there's all these different body poses and colours that seem to possibly suggest a dominance of some of them, like the big bossy octopuses will stand up kind of tall and make themselves look big and dark. They make their bodies very dark. They call it the Nosferatu pose, like this big kind of vampire sort of big looming pose of these octopuses interacting with each other. So they do interact, not necessarily in a friendly way. Why haven't they become more social is a big question, actually. These really intelligent, complex brains they have, why aren't they using them like sperm whales do, the incredible, you know, social networks that they have? Why are octopuses so solitary? We don't really know. We don't really know.
And what's the deal with octopus farms? I mean, what's going on there? Are they a thing now?
Not yet. So many different countries, there's research going on all around the world looking into the possibility of this. So there are the scientific research looking at, could they be reared in large numbers? And that's really what most people are concerned about at the moment is this feasible even? Could you do that? Can you do it on a commercial basis? You know, these are animals which we've talked about already as being really antisocial. They don't like being in tanks with each other. They're carnivores as well. So the environmental impact of rearing an animal that needs to be fed other animals is something to be considered. And what do they eat? Will they only eat live food? You know, that kind of feeding side practicalities people are trying to figure out. But a company in Spain, in the Canary Islands, is, I think, possibly the closest to making this a reality. They've said they want to start rearing octopuses for consumption. They're talking about a facility that would raise a million a year. In a thousand tanks. So that's a lot in each tank.
How big are these tanks going to be?
I don't know. That's the thing I don't know.
A thousand in a tank?
Yeah. Well, 1,000 tanks for a million in a year. I mean, the numbers are pretty mind-blowing. And there's a lot of pushback against this. I should say the reason people are thinking of doing this is, I imagine, partly a response to feeling like wild populations are being overfished. So people do go and hunt octopuses in the wild, and there is a trade in people who want to eat octopuses. I mean, you might have been on holiday, perhaps in the Mediterranean somewhere, and eaten calamari. It might well be octopus that actually isn't squid. It won't be from the Mediterranean. It probably isn't from the Med. There's not really enough left there. I spent time actually working in a really remote part of Madagascar, where there's an octopus fishery, and most of those octopuses get sent to Europe. So people are, you know, eating Malagasy octopuses without realising. I mean, whether that's an issue environmentally in Madagascar is another question. But basically, there is interest in eating octopuses and interest in rearing them and making money out of them, basically. If farming octopuses happened, it wouldn't be to help people who basically need them for food. This is not going to food insecure countries. These farmed octopuses would be going to people who are paying high prices for a really high value product. So this is not about feeding the world. It's about making money. Let's be clear about that. If that's where the farming kind of agenda is going for octopuses. But there is a lot of pushback from scientists, from conservationists, from animal welfare people who are just incredibly concerned about even the possibility of doing this, because it's a very different prospect. On the one hand, maybe keeping a few octopuses in aquarium tanks for displaying people, you know, in public aquariums, and we can talk about whether that's a good thing or not if we want, but it's a very limited number of animals, and they are cared for really very carefully by the people who are, for the most part, who are looking after them. You know, they want their animals to be happy in captivity. I'm not saying if I'm for or against that, but I mean, I think that's a very different case to mass rearing, commercially rearing animals like octopuses, the kind of numbers that we are talking about. Animals that we still don't understand, really, how can we keep them happy or content or at least not depressed? Animals like octopuses, I'm sure, are absolutely vulnerable to that kind of basically just welfare issues, if their surroundings aren't stimulating enough, if they aren't given enough space, if they aren't given the right types of food. People even think, you know, if feeding an octopus at the same time each day, which is no doubt what they would do in a farm, because they'll just be banging it out, you know, 6 o'clock every day. Even that, octopuses need variation in their lives. They need to be surprised. They need stimulating. And we aren't anywhere near understanding what would be required to keep them happy during their lives, keep them content, keep them not suffering. Because whether or not we understand their intelligence, we certainly can grasp the idea that octopuses can suffer. And then comes the big issue of how to kill them. If you're going to farm all these octopuses, how are you going to end their lives? And that's a big question too. I've heard that this farm in Spain is planning to use ice baths, which is a completely untested method, basically plunging them into ice.
Oh, God.
There's no tests at all that I know of in octopuses. There have been some tests in fish and have been shown to be a very stressful and just awful way to
It sounds end life. Like an awful way
yeah. I mean,
to die.
Yeah. It's
Horrendous.
Not like, you know, it's not like that story about a frog being in a boiling pot of water and gently warming it up and then it doesn't realise it's boiling alive. That's another phrase. But, you know, it's not gently being cooled down. It's being plunged into ice. And it's just, yeah, it's kind of unthinkable. I mean, for me, like people, I've talked about this a fair bit and people have said to me, oh, you know, we farm cows, we farm pigs, are very intelligent animals. Sure. I mean, I'm a vegetarian, but let's put that to one side. We do that. But people have also made and continue to make horrible decisions about how we look after those animals, even though we understand those vertebrates, the mammals that are much more like us. We understand them so much more than we do octopuses, and still we treat them badly. How on earth are we going to do anything different with these octopuses? And why bring them into that arena of having to deal with them in that way, having them in our care when we really don't understand what they need? Just for money.
I also think it is 2024 and the general consensus about farming practices worldwide, whether, like you said, whether you're a vegetarian, whether you're vegan, whether whatever you choose to eat, I don't think at this stage in the game we should start to be farming another wild species.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Absolutely. And one that's not needed for solving hunger in the
exactly.
world.
Exactly.
You know, fine, a few people might make some money out of it. Probably not the people who really need to be making money and who rely on the ocean for their livelihoods. This is a new thing that doesn't exist. We don't need to do it. We need to legislate against it before it happens. That's my view anyway, is that, and there's ways to do that. We're seeing already there are some protections for octopuses being put in place. And there's absolutely a way to put that to the point of saying, well, we don't farm them. Let's just not do that.
Yeah.
We can do that.
And I was going to ask you, actually, what would you say are the biggest threats that octopuses currently face?
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing that's clear, but maybe not well understood, is that octopuses, for the most part, live on the seabed. They live associated with the bottom of the sea. They're benthic. So anything that damages any of those habitats that they live in is going to have an effect on them. You know, even if a trawler isn't directly catching an octopus, if a bottom trawler comes along and destroys an area of whatever it might be, seagrass or coral or deep reefs or seaweed meadows, that kind of thing, obviously that's going to affect these animals that need that habitat. So I think we can easily make that connection between any kind of damage to the seabed and the octopuses that require those habitats. We're also taking this to an extreme with the current plans to potentially start deep sea mining. So isn't happening yet. I sure hope it isn't happening by the time you listen to this, because things do move quickly. Mm. Hopefully not. But there are plans afoot increasingly to begin extracting rocks from very deep parts of the ocean. We're talking several miles down where there are metal-rich deposits. One particular area of interest is in the middle of the Pacific, way out between Hawaii and California. It's a huge area of what we call abyssal nodules. So basically rocks sitting around on the seabed. I mean, I remember being taught about these when I was at high school in chemistry classes, because there's a lot of different minerals inside these rocks. They look like bits of coal, but they're made over very long periods. It takes millions of years to form from the water itself, and they contain lots of different metals. And when I was taught about them at school, the idea was that, oh, it's just mud and rocks down there. It's nothing else. You know, maybe one day we'll mine these things. And that was kind of what it was like a few decades ago. Now there's interest, much more feverish interest, in bringing these rocks up because they have metals that could be useful in things like rechargeable batteries in cars and other things as well.
Mm.
But the point is that there is loads more down there in these deep abyssal plains. It's not just mud and rocks. Absolutely not. And the more scientists are looking, the more we're finding. I mean, already we think there's thousands of species, undescribed species, in that just in that one area of the Pacific, including octopuses. People send down these amazing autonomous robots that basically swim through the ocean and take pictures of things and then come back and show you what they've seen. And they're coming back with lots of images of these ghostly white octopuses. They were nicknamed Casper the Octopus. They haven't actually been named yet because no one has got a specimen and actually looked at it properly. They've just been captured on camera. But they do, they've got this kind of slightly stumpy arms, very white, pale skin, little beady black eyes, sitting down on the seabed several miles from the surface in these nodule fields. And in particular, what's happening, we've got images of the females brooding their eggs on the rocks. Basically, you get sort of stalks of sponges that grow onto the rocks with that, that sort of, that's the basis of that habitat. And the octopuses lay their eggs on their sponges and then look after them and hold onto them. So it's their habitat. This is where they're raising their young. They rely on this these undulating flat plains covered in these incredibly important rocks, not just for the octopus, but for so much else. So yeah, so if we started mining those areas for the first time, opening up that huge area of wilderness to this industrial process, it would absolutely have an impact on these incredible species like Casper the octopus.
And can you tell us about the octopus nursery?
In another part of the deep ocean, in the Pacific, but closer to the coast, off the coast of California and also off Costa Rica, scientists have found a couple of places where a lot of octopuses hang out together. Again, this is not really a community, but this is octopuses using a particular part of the seabed that works for them. So one in particular is, it's been nicknamed the Octopus Garden. It's off the coast of Monterey Bay. And you might have seen it if you've seen the latest series of Planet Earth. I think it's Planet Earth 3. You might have seen the octopus nursery in that. And it's incredible. Like, scientists have basically using, again, these kind of deep water cameras to get an idea of the area. They think there's 20,000 of these octopuses all hanging out together. They're all females. They're all rearing their eggs. These are sort of grapefruit-sized octopuses. They're called the pearl octopus because they are sort of pearly pink in colour. And when you see them from a distance, it does just look like there's pearls scattered over the seabed. There's so many of them. They're holding onto their eggs. They've got their arms wrapped around. And the reason they're all there is because warm water is percolating up through the seabed. It's on the side of a big underwater mountain. And it's basically just a bit warmer there. It's like kind of sort of the Three Bears sort of Goldilocks idea. The rest of the deep ocean is very cold. It's, you know, it gets down to sort of 4 degrees, 2 degrees Celsius. And these warm springs are more like 10 degrees. And it's speeding up the development of their eggs. If these females weren't in that area, they think it would take probably 10 years or longer for the eggs to hatch. 10 years!
Wow.
And the females are there the whole time looking after them. That's another incredible thing about octopuses. Another species not too far from there was seen, a species of octopus was seen not on the thermal spring, but in a different part, incubating her eggs in the same spot without moving for 4.5 years. The longest incubation brooding period of any animal.
That's commitment.
She just sat there guarding her eggs from predators until they hatched, and then, you know, then she dies as well. And that's what octopuses do. The females basically rear their young and then that's it. And but these other, going back to the octopus nursery, the idea that there's this one, well, certainly there must be multiple places, and we know there's a few others in the Pacific, and probably loads more that we haven't found yet. But they find these parts of the deep sea that help them, you know, speed things up so they don't have such a long wait for their young to grow. And they sit there and stay a bit warmer. And it's only 2 years for their young to hatch, which is also a really long time. And it's an incredible ecosystem. I mean, the story of octopuses is really strange, that they have these complex lives and these rich nerve systems and these, you know, they are these incredible, intelligent, extraordinary creatures. But they only live for 2 years, at least the ones in the shallow seas. Deep sea octopuses do live longer. But 2 years is the average lifespan of an octopus, and that's just weird. We don't really know why. And they reproduce just this one time, and the females, you know, look after their young and then they die. But what you see in this octopus nursery is that that's all part of the ecosystem. There's just loads of other things as well. There's anemones, there's fish, there's crabs, there's shrimp. It's like a little oasis. And it's all thanks to the octopuses coming in to have their babies. And I love that we didn't know about this until a couple of years ago. I actually spoke to the scientist who found it. And just the discoveries we're making are so mind-blowing. You think we know the ocean, but we really don't. And you can come across just extraordinary sights like 20,000 octopuses all sitting on the seabed, quietly rearing their babies. And we didn't know about it before. It's really cool.
Well, Helen, listen, thank you so much for coming on today. I'm a true Argonaut fan now. I was an octopus fan, but that's it. I want to get one of those t-shirts.
They're all good. Get a t-shirt. Go and check out Argonauts. Have a look for some videos there. Yeah.
Thank you. You've been brilliant.
You've been wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week, we're turning away from the wilderness and we're meeting the people of the sea. It's not just wild animals who rely on the oceans for their livelihoods. Humans do too. But if you can't wait until then, here's something else for you.
My name is Gretchen Frew-Green and I work as a professor, as a researcher at the university here in Zurich, Switzerland. I was one of the first people to discover this special hydrothermal system that we call Lost City. We were doing this camera survey in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and studying this mountain that is called the Atlantis Massif. Two of my colleagues made a dive down with a submarine, and it really looks like a city. It looks like church towers. These towers have spires, so they're pointy, and they're bright white, really contrasting to the darkness around that the seawater is at that depth. It's beautiful. It's like stalagmites, stalactites in a cave. When we first found this, we were puzzled at the very beginning. And then when we realized that we were looking at a hydrothermal system and that it was very, very different than what was ever found before, we were very excited. And these environments are thought to be one place where life could have evolved during the early Earth. So it was really the most exciting moment in my academic career. When you think about it, there's only about 10% of the ocean floor that's been investigated. So there's a lot that we do not know. And by studying the oceans and studying the seafloor, we've learned how our Earth has evolved and how life and water and air interact. I'm Gretchen Frew-Green, and I'm a researcher of the ocean.
This episode was brought to you by Greenpeace and Crowd Network. It's hosted by me, wildlife filmmaker and broadcaster Hannah Stitfel. It's produced by Anna Stauffenberg, and our executive producer is Steve Jones. Editing and sound design by Anna Stauffenberg. The music we use is from our partners, BMG Production Music, archive courtesy of Greenpeace. The team at Crowd Network is Catalina Nogueira, Archie Biltcliffe, George Sampson, and Robert Wallace. The team at Greenpeace is James Hansen, Flora Havesi, Alex Yallop, Janae Mayer, and Alice Lloyd Hunter. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next week.